Good morning. I am Darrell Gunter, your host for Leadership on WSOU 89.5 FM. Today, we're very pleased to have Ms. Judith Scheff, the Associate Vice President of Technology Development at New Jersey Institute of Technology. Judith, welcome to the program, and thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedule to be with us today to share with us your views on leadership. How are you doing today?
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here and to speak with your audience about leadership and entrepreneurship activities.
So tell us a little bit about your experience and background, because you have been involved in corporate America, working for, of course, AT&T Bell Labs and Lucent, and you had some very interesting activities with them. Share with our audience a little bit about your background.
Great. I started, as you said, I got a degree in mathematics from the University of Illinois, so I'm a Midwestern person. And I started out at Bell Labs in Naperville, Illinois, working on traffic engineering methodologies for the large switching systems. This was back in the day when the integrated circuits were somewhat expensive, and we need to very carefully size the switching system so that they'd be able to handle the peak load traffics that would go through them. And as your listeners may know, the highest calling volume in the switching systems occur on Mother's Day, and so we wanted to protect so that every child parent would be able to get their calls through on Mother's Day. I then moved on to the business side of AT&T in the semiconductor area, working on international strategies and development for AT&T. And I did a lot of work internationally, focused with NEC in Japan and some companies in China as we looked to expand and globalize our business. We came to realize that it was important to be able to collaborate and work on strategic alliances with other companies, and that all the brains and all the ideas weren't going to be resonating at one place. And then after a really wonderful career with AT&T that ultimately became Lucent, and then the semiconductor piece of the business became Gear, I retired after 26 years and then joined New Jersey Institute of Technology.
Now, at Lucent, if I understand correctly, you were part of the engineering process that led to their being sold to Alcatel, is that correct?
The piece of the company, AT&T, went through a period known as trivestiture and divestiture, and the piece of the business that I was with ultimately became known as Lucent. And then after I had left Lucent, Alcatel purchased that piece of the business.
And what was your role in the sale to Alcatel?
Well, I hadn't been with them at the time that they were selling to Alcatel. I was there when we had divested from AT&T, and I was really involved, Darrell, with looking at the intellectual property assets of the business, deciding which patents should come with the new business, which patents remained with AT&T, because as you can well imagine, intellectual property is such a fundamental piece of a business's core value. There was a bit of fighting going on between which patents belonged with which piece of the business.
Right. Because that's where the value is.
Yes.
That's where the value. And what led you to NJIT? What was it about the opportunity that said, you know, I'm going to move into academe versus to stay in the corporate world?
I had decided that I wanted to find a way to continue to utilize my skills managing intellectual property and developing strategic alliances. And I started actually reading the Star Ledger Sunday business section, looking at what kind of jobs were available. And one thought I had at one point was to possibly go into teaching. I have a degree in mathematics. And I thought maybe I remembered enough of my high school math that I could go back and become a high school math teacher, since I knew there's such a great shortage of teachers in the technical field. And as I was looking and pursuing different job opportunities, I saw that New Jersey Institute of Technology was looking to bring someone on to help them manage their intellectual property portfolio. And since it was the same kind of skills I had worked on at Lucent, I thought this would be a great opportunity to work in a different environment.
Well, at NJIT, you are responsible for something called tech transfer, technology transfer. Can you provide our audience with a definition of what is technology transfer and exactly what do you do with that?
Certainly. Tech transfer really refers to taking technology that's been developed at the university and transferring it out to the public so that the inventions that are created will ultimately turn into goods and services and value for the citizens of this country who have helped fund the development through various government-sponsored research programs. All universities have tech transfer departments. It was founded back in the 1980s as a result of some Bayh-Dole legislation, which gave universities the right to get ownership of their intellectual property in exchange for agreeing to commercialize the technology. So what I do on a daily basis is I work with faculty, staff, students who've made inventions, and they come to our office. They fill out a form that's known as an invention disclosure form. They describe the work that they've done, and we then assess the invention and make a determination as to whether or not we want to file for a patent. Now, filing for a patent is a different decision than saying, is the idea of scientific merit? Because all the ideas are going to be of scientific merit. The question is, if I spend the money to get a patent, to get intellectual property protection for this idea, is that going to be a good business decision? Is someone going to want to then start a business up around the technology and use patents as the basis of raising money for their business? Or will a large company who's in that particular area decide that this is a fabulous technology and I'd like to license it to augment my particular business product line? So we're really looking at the business side of things much more so than we're trying to judge the scientific merit, because we need to decide, if I spend all this money, is there going to be a return at the end of the day?
And what is the criteria that you use to determine if something is a good commercial item that you want to commercialize? Is there a set criteria, or is it that you know it when you see it?
It's a little bit of you know it when you see it, but we also do some market research and we deal with various consultants who will help us evaluate ideas. We try to take a look at the market and see where markets are going to say, is this something that's going to be a large enough market opportunity that we think someone who starts up a business around it will be able to make money off of it? We ask questions, is this a fundamental change in the way things are being done, or is this just a small little add-on feature that, while yes, it's wonderful and you could get a patent on it, not very many people are going to be interested in this little additional add-on feature to the technology. We try to look at, are the markets only in the U.S. or are there international markets associated with it? And then we ask the inventors, because the inventors have gone to a lot of scientific conferences, and we ask them, when you've talked about the work that you've done, or you've published papers, who's expressed interest in the work that you've done to really get a sense as to what's the commercial opportunity? But again, it's always very challenging because work that's done in the university is so early stage from a development standpoint that it's hard to necessarily know where the markets are ultimately going to go. Some of the inventions that have been developed at universities have been things such as the Google search engine, which was developed by a couple of students who were looking actually at library research activities. And I'm sure at the time they were starting their work, no one anticipated that that was ultimately going to be the large business that it is today. Another business that was started based on some academic research at a university has been Gatorade. It was a special drink that was developed down in the University of Florida to help the Florida Gators be a better athletic team, and ultimately now is on supermarket shelves around the country and probably around the world.
That's right. That's right. And what happens if a particular inventor, his or her invention is not accepted to move forward? Does it stop there, or do they continue with their idea?
Well, generally, if we make a decision not to move ahead with the invention, we'll give the inventor the opportunity himself or herself to be able to move forward through the patenting process if it's something that they feel strongly enough that they would like to go ahead with. On the other hand, even if there's not a patent associated with it, generally our inventors are continuing to work in in that same technical area. So they're still moving ahead with their ideas in those fields. And as I said, you know, sometimes because it's very early technology, we may guess wrong. Hopefully we've guessed right most of the time.
Can you share with us some of the exciting technology or products or applications that have been developed through your tech transfer department?
Certainly. We have done a lot of work in our electrical and computer engineering area with some technology associated with data hiding techniques, which again are used for advanced activities in terms of cybersecurity, in terms of being able to keep advanced information safe and secure, knowing that information has not been tampered with. And we've been working with some companies out in the West Coast in terms of taking a large portfolio of our technologies in that area. Additionally, we have a faculty member, Cam Sirkar, in our chemical engineering department who has done a phenomenal amount of work with advanced membrane technologies. Some of his work is being used for water desalinization projects, and he's been working with the U.S. Department of Reclamation as well as some collaborators outside the U.S., and his technology also is being used to clean up VOC airstreams in pharmaceutical manufacturing.
How do you get your engineers, your technology folks, to think in a commercial basis in regards to they have the technology, but how do you get them to make the transition from taking this technology from being something very interesting that they've discovered to something that's very practical and applicable that the consumer market can use or that the business market could use?
So you're talking about an area that is sometimes known in the tech transfer world as the Valley of Death. And you're trying to take this invention, this idea, which was developed from a scientific curiosity standpoint, and now you need to move it from an area where we may have gotten funding, typically from perhaps the National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health. You've got to get it across this chasm where it's got that commercialized, where it's translated into a commercial form. Sometimes we've been able to get some funding from the state of New Jersey, from the Commission on Science and Technology, where we were able to use some gap funding to take some of these inventions and translate them into a form that would be a little bit more commercially relevant so that you would be able to talk to someone who was interested in licensing the technology and say, see, we've gotten it proved up, we've gotten it beyond the stage of just the beaker or test tube in the lab stage. We've gotten a little bit more data and a little bit more proof of concept associated with it. Sometimes some of our faculty are interested in starting up businesses around their technology, and they're able to get some angel funding or some venture funding to try to move the technology forward. And frequently, they'll need to bring in other people to help them work with the invention, someone who's got that commercial perspective. So it's really a sort of back and forth continuum from the academic perspective to the commercial perspective, a little bit of a push-pull in commercialization.
Very nice, very nice. When did you first realize that in your technical field that you are a leader? And did you aspire to be a leader, or did it just happen?
I think on the question of leadership, one thing that that strikes me when I was a young manager at AT&T, there was a large meeting that was taking place, and my boss was supposed to run the meeting, and everyone was assembled in this conference room waiting for him to show up. And after about 5-10 minutes, when he hadn't shown up and we had all these people here, I decided we just needed to move ahead, and I just picked up the agenda and started moving with it. And I think that was, as I said, one of the things. You just kind of just have to do it.
And when the manager arrived, what was his reaction that the meeting was well underway?
He was actually pleased that we had gotten things moving, that we weren't wasting time, that things were moving ahead. So he was very, very pleased that we had moved along. And we continue to be friends to this day.
And did you find that your peers started to look at you a little bit differently?
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, as you become a leader and you start taking roles. You have to, you're moving away from the friendship where everyone is perhaps looking at the same thing and asking the same sets of questions. And then as you start to become a leader, people get a little bit cautious sometimes of saying, can I share everything that I used to share before?
Right, right.
And then coming back the other direction, as a leader, you may be privy to information that, again, you need to temper in terms of how much you're able to share going back the other direction as well.
And how did you develop yourself as a leader? Was there some additional formal training? How did you get on your path to be a leader?
Well, I was very fortunate to be part of, as you said, the AT&T Bell system, because they had a number of courses that they have their managers participate in that are in-house courses and seminars that were given. And additionally, I ended up indicating that I wanted to learn a little bit more about the business side of things. As I mentioned, I had a degree in mathematics. And I ended up going to the Wharton School, and I got an executive MBA from the Wharton School with a concentration in international business. And I was, as I said, fortunate that I was working for AT&T, Western Electric at the time, and it was part of their continuing education and tuition reimbursement program.
What are the key traits of a great leader, in your opinion?
I think a leader needs to have a couple of things. They need to have a vision, a bigger vision of where they want to take an organization. And then a leader needs to be able to articulate that vision and that direction in a way that gets everyone in the organization excited about where they want to go so that they can all push in the same direction. And it has to be a vision that's easy enough to articulate that everyone understands what it means. Everyone knows, here's where we're trying to go. Here's the vision. And then beyond that, a leader needs to be able to listen and get input from people within their organization. A leader can't possibly know it all. A leader needs to surround himself or herself with others who have complementary skills and are able to provide input in the direction that you need to go.
And who have been some of the great leaders that have inspired you throughout your career?
I think that one of the people who was a fabulous leader that I worked at AT&T Microelectronics is Kurt Crawford, and he's currently running a company out in California called XCEO, and he was someone who really took a chance on me, mm-hmm. who gave me some opportunities early on to be a leader and to move ahead, and I really always remember that.
And how would you describe your leadership style?
I think my leadership style is open, collaborative, sometimes a little bit too hands-on in terms of wanting to know all the details and know perhaps a little bit too much. And I also think, though, I'm a caring leader, that I like to know not only where we're moving the organization forward, but also how are the people in the organization feeling about things? What's also going on in their life, and how do we balance work, family issues so that everyone can be successful with what they do?
You know, one of the areas of concern that I have within corporate America, mm-hmm. whether it's private or public corporations, is that as I talk to different CEOs, I get a sense that some of the people, even one level below them, really do not understand the strategy of the company. Why is that? Why does that happen?
Well, again, I think it's back to the issue of communication. You need to be able to communicate where you're going. And sometimes in today's environment, perhaps people are so short-staffed that they don't take the time to stop and communicate and make sure that everyone knows where they're going. And sometimes organizations will hold town meetings, will hold breakfast coffees, multi-layer opportunities for people to come in and talk with different people to make sure they understand where they're going. And if you don't communicate, it's going to be really tough to move an organization forward, because people won't know why they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, or even if there are opportunities, they won't seize on those opportunities because they won't recognize that that's part of the strategy and the direction that that they need to take. I think it's also important, the same way, as I said, Kurt Crawford gave me opportunities, we need to give people opportunities to both succeed and maybe fail. Give them an opportunity to try something, and if they're stretching and growing and something doesn't quite work out, you say, okay, well, maybe that didn't quite work out, but here's how we can fix that situation. Or maybe someone needs to go back and get a little bit more training in a particular skill set to be able to move ahead.
You know, you're leading into my next question, which is training. Oftentimes, we put people in to do a particular task, but they haven't been given the proper information and the proper training. Have you seen a growth in training in corporate America, or have you seen a decline in training of corporate America staff?
No, I actually think there's been an increase in training, and with the technology available, people themselves need to become what's known as lifelong learners. So as an individual, whether your company is going to give you, quote, formal training or not, you need to be a lifelong learner. You need to stay abreast of what's happening in your industry, what's happening in your community, what's going on, what are some of the latest trends, perhaps with respect to a particular technology that you're using, everything from knowing how to tweet to how to text message. And if you don't know how to do some of these skills, ask the nearest 11-year-old, and I'm sure they'll be able to help you out. But everyone needs to be able to be open to say, how do I grow and enhance myself? And with, as I said, with the new skills available, particularly some of the distance learning capabilities, people can watch webinars 24/7. NJIT recently joined the MIT OpenCourseWare Consortium, so a number of our courses are going to be up on the web, the curriculum, so that people can themselves go in and take a look and learn things.
You know, you bring a good point to bear, because John Blossom, one of my guests, mm-hmm. who is the author of Content Nation, he talked about how there's so much access to information. You can get a little notebook PC now for, what, $150 connected
yes.
to the internet. And now, as you said, you can connect to MIT OpenCourseWare and get access to all of this great information. So how does one get started? The internet is so vast, so big. What advice would you give someone who wants to mm-hmm. learn more about leadership and they want to use the web and they're an entrepreneur? What is the first step you would give them?
Well, I guess I would look at two particular. I guess there's three things that I would do. I am such a big fan of Google. I do Google searching all the time. You put in a couple of keywords, you get back the search results, and you start going off and checking out the links and maybe say, I'm going to spend 20 minutes and see where some of these things take me. And then I'll open up another Word document. And if I find an interesting link to something that looks good, I'll copy and paste the link into this other document with a couple little footnotes as my way of keeping track of places that I want to go back and explore. Additionally, as I said, you know, the MIT site has, through their OpenCourseWare site, has a lot of interesting information on leadership, and you can go there and take a look. And then Stanford University, through one of their websites that deals with entrepreneurship, has a lot of video snippets of different leaders, particularly in the entrepreneurial space, where you can watch the whole lecture that might have been an hour, but then they have it broken up. So if you only got 5 minutes and you want to hear someone speaking for 5 minutes on doing a venture pitch, you can listen to the 5-minute piece and then come back to other parts later.
Very nice, very nice. So there's a wealth of information, and it just got to get started.
Just got to get started. Kind of put your toe in the water and away you go.
So how does one prepare themselves to be a great leader? Are leaders born? Are they made? Are they formed? How does someone become a great leader, in your opinion?
Well, I think that people who are going to become leaders, some of it is a little bit of that internal drive to want to be a leader. Some people don't want to be responsible for others, so they're going to be the great people who will be the mass, the base, pushing pushing things forward. But other people really do want to take those challenges. And you have opportunities throughout your whole life. Young people have opportunities in school, in scouting, at church and synagogue youth groups to try and take different leadership positions. You may not want to be a leader in your corporate life, but perhaps there's an issue that really fires you up, and as you're part of a charity organization or a volunteer organization, you may be the one who's a leader running a particular project in that environment. Similarly, you may be very interested and engaged with what's going on within your community, and you may take a leadership role running for the school board or perhaps other parts of your local government. And then you can mold yourself by looking at leaders, reading books about leadership, finding someone who really inspires you, and reading about their story and seeing how some of those lessons may apply to you. And I think the may apply to you part is so important, because people just can't say, I'm going to do and follow in someone else's footsteps, because their story is not your story. You need to create your own path.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Now, you have a couple of books that you want to share with us.
Yes.
In regards to leadership. Three Cups of Tea.
Yes.
Let's talk about Three Cups of Tea.
Three Cups of Tea was written by a mountaineer named Greg Mortensen, and he loved to climb mountains, and he was climbing the mountains in Pakistan, and as he was coming down, he managed to get separated from the team that he was climbing with and really got lost up in the high Himalayas. And as he was coming down, he was really rescued by villagers in a small rural town in Pakistan, really rural village in Pakistan. And eventually he got back to the United States, but he had made a promise to them that he would come back and help them build schools, particularly for the young girls in the community, because the girls didn't have a school to learn in, and they were sitting outside in the elements trying to learn. There were very few books that they had. So he came back to the U.S., and he was a nurse, and he spent time then trying to raise money. He was fortunate in that he managed to connect with a philanthropist who then really kick-started some of his activity, and he went back to Pakistan, and he went back to that village, and he built that first school, and then it just mushroomed from there. People learned about his story and helped contribute to what he was doing. One piece that I found so interesting when he talked about not being discouraged with what he was doing, because he was a mountaineer, he went to many different mountain hiking clubs to tell about what he was doing, trying to raise money. And he was at a lecture in Minneapolis, and he was in the store, in the hiking store, and they had maybe 50 seats set up, and there were very few people who were listening to his lecture. And he had, you know, indicated that it maybe only cost $20,000 to be able to build the school and to outfit it with all of the school supplies. And he was kind of discouraged because, as I said, there was very few people in the audience. And after the lecture was over and he went to pick up materials, on one of the chairs in the back there was a donation for $20,000 from the one person who had, one of the people who had, few people who had listened to his talk. So you can't give up. You just got to keep doing what you're doing.
So here's a gentleman lost in the mountains. Mm-hmm. And these folks, they help him out, and next thing you know, he gets this vision, and he gets this passion.
Yes.
And I guess that speaks to that a leader has to have passion.
Yes.
And about the three cups of tea, what's the significance of the three cups?
The title, Three Cups of Tea, comes from the notion that when you share tea with someone, the first cup, you're just still trying to get to know them. The second cup, you're getting a little bit further involved and engaged with them. And by the time you drink that third cup,